Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Midrash, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One, from the blog Eagle Speak. And for all our regular listeners, we appreciate your patience over our summer battles with technical problems and storms. We've got everybody on board today. A real good show. As a reminder for those who are live, make sure and join us in the chat room at the bottom of the show page. You'll see the link. It'll take you right there, and you can mix it up with the usual suspects. If you have any questions or observations you want to share, Eagle One will be in the chat room. We'll kind of herd those questions and comments together and fold it right in for us. And if you're one of our frequent flyers, if you want to call in, please feel free. The number's right there on the show page. And if you're new to Midrats, or if you've missed some of our shows you want to catch up, also want to remind you, all the archives can be found on Blog Talk Radio, or you can set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes to get things running on a regular basis. Now that the intro's done, let's get on with the show. We got two subjects that we're going to talk about today, kind of a clear break between the two. First of all, we want to talk about where we stand. The news this week, of course, was with the last Brigade Combat Team, officially titled as such, departed across the Iraq-Kuwait border heading south, leaving behind approximately 50,000 of our service members there to help the Iraqis as they try to transition to a usable form of government. And in that, we've had a better part of a decade of a real big focus on counterinsurgency with a big infantry from big emphasis on the light infantry side of the house. And it's important when you get through or are in the process of transitioning from one conflict to another that you don't let unique lessons blur into your plans for the future. And that's what we want to talk about today, is as we prepare to have a force that is balanced and prepared to meet the reasonable spectrum of threats that we see down the road, are we where we want to be? And to discuss that with us today is retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas A. McGregor. He is the author of the Naval Institute Press's Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Eastling, and also Transformation Under Fire, Revolutionizing How America Fights. Now, before we get to the macro scene that I kind of talked about there, I wanted to shift down to the tactical side of the house, back to the First Gulf War, which is the subject of Colonel McGregor's book, Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Eastling. And before we get into that, Colonel McGregor, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thanks very much.
We really appreciate the time you've had to come on today. And, of course, for the listeners, you can find links to his books up on my homepage. And I would also invite you to look back a couple of days. There's a link that Dan Rather did with Doug that would further outline some of his thoughts. It's really worth your time to go ahead and see that short video. But before we get to the big things there, Doug, let's go back to what I mentioned a minute ago, back down to the tactical scene. A lot of the big players that we see in our present battle cut their teeth back in the First Gulf War. I know that outgoing over a year ago, General Craddock, whose outgoing speeches when he was leaving NATO, I think is required listening for everybody if they really want to know what the challenges are working with our allies. But we have also had a lot of those major players that experienced what was it, the army that we had for the Cold War, had that great set-piece battle going in there. And I believe that Brigadier General McMaster had a significant role in that as well. When you look at back at the Battle of 73 Eastling, what role and what was the critical importance of that battle in the campaign that we had back in Desert Storm.
Well, first let me correct something. There was nothing set piece about the Battle of 73 Easting. I think that the Army leadership in particular over many, many years has been enamored of the set piece battle. That was part of what led ultimately to the strategic failure of the 1991 campaign called Desert Storm. Ultimately, it did not accomplish anything of enduring strategic value for the United States, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. And the Battle of 73 Easting ultimately occurs in spite of the chain of command, in spite of the general officers, in spite of even the regimental commander. There was no appetite to close with and destroy the enemy in 1991. There was an enormous amount of fear on the part of the chain of command reaching all the way up to Colin Powell that we were about to embark on something that would result in tremendous casualties that could last a long time. I think most of that was a function of the complete failure to understand the nature of the enemy that we were confronting and also to understand what had changed in warfare and the kind of warfare we were going to be involved in 1991. And that, of course, bore no resemblance to the formative experience of those officers, which was Vietnam. They saw warfare as lots of draftees carrying rifles that could not operate beyond the range of their artillery, most of whom didn't want to be there, and most of whom didn't understand what they were doing and thought they should leave. The situation in 1991 was very, very different. And our mission, and the mission I describe in the book, Warrior's Rage, was a very straightforward one. We were supposed to lead the offensive in the 7th Corps across southern Iraq to find and ultimately destroy the Republican Guard Corps. And General Schwarzkopf did accurately reach the conclusion that the one thing that we had to accomplish in 1991 was either the destruction or the capture of that Republican Guard Corps, a force of perhaps 80 to 90,000 men. They were the people that were most likely to fight. In fact, I think in many cases, they were the only people who were willing to fight, and they were well equipped for the mission. But of course, they were another Arab force, and most Arab armies were not very effective. And as one of my lieutenants pointed out, who was quite frustrated with the expressions of fear and timidity in the chain of command above us, said, look, no Arab army has defeated a European enemy since the Renaissance. Why are all of these generals worried? And I think that just about summed it up. But we were extremely well trained. We were very well prepared. We were well equipped. We did a lot of things very differently from the rest of the army, quite frankly, in the squadron that I was in as the S3, and ultimately I led it. And the result was this devastating victory over the enemy that really never engaged all of our combat power. We were able to use a lot of it, but not all of it. And this victory actually did nothing for us, frankly. We were successful, but there was no willingness to exploit it, no willingness to follow up. And quite frankly, as I explain in the book, by the time we finally closed with the enemy over everyone's objections, most of the Republican Guard Corps has already successfully withdrawn across the Euphrates River. So the result is that Saddam Hussein remained in power, his regime remained in power, and it became almost immediately an instantaneous irritant because those Republican Guard forces, re-equipped, paid in hard currency from European bank reserves, was able to not only restore order but to present a new threat to Kuwait and its surroundings. Schwarzkopf admitted that within 60 days of the end of the campaign, he was telling people in interviews that the Republican Guard had escaped, and we saw it attack south towards Kuwait in the fall of 1995, which surprised numbers of people that didn't expect it to happen, and we then embarked upon a long-term bombing campaign that we called an air exclusion zone that went on for many, many years all the way up to our intervention in 2003. So the point is that 1991 was not the titanic victory that had been presented to the American people. The Iraqi enemy was not what the generals thought and certainly not what the generals portrayed to the American people. We missed our opportunity in 1991, and we had to go back in 2003, at least in the view of many people, and rectify that situation. Well, ultimately, I don't think we did. I think we made matters worse, but that's another topic for discussion.
Eagle One.
Well, you, in at least one of the speeches I've heard you give, you discussed that we should have taken more or less taken the Iraqi army up with us, kind of co-opted them, turned them into part of our team, and driven north into Baghdad using
that. Now, you mean in 2003.
Okay.
Yes, that was my recommendation in 2003, without question, and it was absolutely doable. But for some reason, despite our success, at least working through surrogates in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002, where literally we had people on the ground paying various tribal groups to work with us to drive the Taliban out, we didn't do that on the approach to Baghdad in 2003 when there was widespread willingness to work with us. Most of the Iraqi army absolutely did not fight. Its commanders were actually called on the phone by us in their headquarters and told, if you stay in your barracks, you keep your troops where they are, you will have a role in the future Iraq, and you will not be attacked. And most of them complied. We met, by the standards of warfare, almost no resistance at all on the way to Baghdad in 2003. But again, you know, the general officers saw danger everywhere, grossly exaggerated what they were encountering, and they did not, or they were not told to pick up and utilize any of these Iraqi forces. Because whatever you did, once you entered that country, you wanted the new leadership to wear an Iraqi face. I mean, one of the things that I point out when people express frustration with the sense of failure in competition with Iran for influence in today's Iraq is that whereas Iranian influence from day one inside Iraq, once Baghdad fell, always wore an indigenous face and spoke the language and could communicate effectively with the population, our occupation wore a foreign face, wore a uniform, and carried a gun. And in that part of the world, that approach doesn't work very well. It never has.
From your perspective in Iraq, you know, you're speaking of some of the hesitancy of the general officers. How did that play in or reinforce some of the attitudes that we had in the State Department and the civilian side of the house that was supposed to move in and help build a civil government?
Well, first of all, you know, we talk a lot about the so-called civilian surge that's supposed to happen in various places. But again, if you look at the successful experiences that we have had when we've operated in other people's countries, they've been successful not because we flooded the place with Americans, but because we rapidly put the people that lived in those countries in charge. I mean, a good example of that was Japan. And we didn't start out on the right foot. Initially, MacArthur had been given specific instructions to lock up all of the so-called Japanese militarists, industrialists that had any hand in the previous regime, and he obediently did so. And 2 years later, it looked as though Japan would become a communist state, and George Kennan was sent by the Secretary of State to meet privately with MacArthur, and Kennan told him, you must immediately release all of these people you've been calling war criminals, put them back in charge. Well, we did that. That became the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, and until quite recently, for over 50 years, that party ruled Japan. That party was very successful in rebuilding the country, but keep in mind the people that did the rebuilding were the people that we'd been fighting. But we recognized that they were critical to the future of the country. So we were able to make that successful, not because of something we did per se. We didn't send people in to rebuild Japan. The Japanese did that. We supported it and assisted it, but it was the Japanese who took the lead. You had a very similar set of circumstances in Germany, by the way. That's not what we did in Iraq from day one. Jay Garner, who is an American lieutenant general, was sent in there initially with a checkbook and instructions to essentially rapidly restore the Iraqi army, to bring it back on active duty. And we had large numbers of Iraqi troops reporting to battalion commanders and brigade commanders in the 3rd Infantry Division in the first few weeks after the regime fell, asking for orders, you know, telling them, we're here, we're ready to go onto the streets, we'll restore order, we'll do what you want. And this went on for several weeks. None of the generals would make a decision. No one would take responsibility. And then subsequently, we get this man, Brenner, who is sent in by the president, presumably on the advice of Mr. Cheney and Dr. Wolfowitz, to effectively dismantle the country, occupy it, govern it with American military power, presumably on the assumption that we could rebuild this place in our own image. Of course, that doesn't work. It didn't work. And we've had a disaster on our hands ever since. But I would say that the notion that somehow or another the quote-unquote State Department failed, I think, is very misleading. It's always the military in a conflict setting that is first on the scene. And you've got to have people on the scene willing to accept responsibility, to make decisions, to do things. We had a chain of command that made it very clear they didn't want responsibility for anything, and they certainly were not prepared to be held accountable for anything. So in the absence of guidance, in the absence of any leadership, they chose to do nothing.
Eagle One.
Well, of all the lessons that you've seemed to have taken from your experience in the first Iraqi war, you seem to be calling for a much leaner chain of command and a much more forward-oriented chain of command. Are those fair statements?
Well, I don't know what forward means.
You've criticized the decision-making from the rear bunkers rather than people being out.
I understand. You have to have people who are forward and on the ground, but it has to be more than bravery in a tactical sense. I mean, for instance, General Mattis received kudos from me because he did go forward, and he actually did evaluate the opposition that he saw, and he recognized there wasn't much there. The Army generals collectively did not do that. They tended to fight war as backseat drivers, which has been an historic problem in the United States Army, I would argue, for a very, very long time, reaching all the way back to the First World War. But that's not enough. You've got to have people that have taken the time to study what they're being asked to do, to have some sort of feel for the people they're going to fight, the people they're dealing with, to know limitations. I mean, for instance, soon after we arrived in Baghdad, and that was, about 2.5 weeks, wasn't even a three-week campaign. And quite frankly, from my vantage point, it should have been over in a week, but that's neither here nor there. It lasted about 2.5 weeks. When Brenner finally shows up a month later and he makes the announcement that he's going to dismantle the government, disband the Iraqi army and police and administration, he tells the group of assembled general officers, Army, Marine, Air Force, and so forth, what he's going to do. Not a single solitary general officer raised objections. No one said, "Mr. Brenner, we are not constituted to do this. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the wherewithal. We haven't prepared to do this. And by the way, there is no evidence in the history of this region that Muslim Arabs, under any circumstances, will tolerate direct rule from non-Muslim foreigners, particularly Europeans. So we think this is a bad idea." No one raised objections except one individual in the room. It was an Army full colonel who raised his hand and said, "You know, Mr. Brenner, we could be creating a conflict that we could otherwise avoid. These men will turn against us once we disband this army and move into their society." That's what was so disturbing to me and continues to be disturbing, that no one is willing to stand up and say, "Wait a minute, this makes no sense."
You know, I remember I was on a CONUS staff when that took place, and I remember sitting around in a room when that came off, and one of my colleagues said, "Well, they just disbanded them." We all just kind of looked at each other, and another guy in the room said, "We're not going anywhere anytime soon." And I think that bore out pretty well. We talk about learning institutions. Do you think that what we saw with the, lack of a better phrase, the Sunni awakening and the work that we started to do in Anbar with the Sunni tribes, was that the end or the beginning of a process where people went, "Okay, that was stupid. How do we try to pick up the pieces?" Or was that a separate train of thought that helped us work together with them?
Well, there were attempts in 2005 to try and reach the Sunni Arab leaders. We already saw evidence in 2005 that the same Sunni Arab tribal leaders who had invited al-Qaeda into the country to help them against us now had serious misgivings about al-Qaeda. I mean, one of the things that we did early on was essentially treat everyone and anyone who took a shot at us as a quote-unquote terrorist. Anybody who didn't like us, anybody who seemed to be opposed to having us, was suddenly a terrorist and had some sort of connection to al-Qaeda. This, of course, was absurd. And then then we started listening to these arguments about al-Qaeda being in the country and taking it over. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Shiites wanted, obviously, nothing to do with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is even more opposed to the Shiites than they are to us. And the Sunni Arabs have a history of moderation in Iraq. And remember that you'd had decades of secular leadership from the Ba'athists they had done everything they could, actually speaking, to suppress religion. In fact, one of the Arab officers that I was dealing with a few years ago who came over to visit, you know, made the point that in 2000 and actually in 1991, the mosques in Basra, for instance, which is now the sort of centerpiece of Shia Islamism, were empty. Nobody was in them. And that was even more true in the Sunni Arab population. We recognized that, and we started making moves in those directions. But for various reasons, there was opposition to it inside the administration. And as a result, we backed off. And I think over time, people at the lowest levels realized there were ways to do business with the local inhabitants. And ultimately, we did. Now, some of that had to do with fighting, because an awful lot of what happens in an Arab society doesn't have direct impact on you. In other words, there's a lot of criminality and there's a lot of cultural baggage. These things tend to produce pathologies, social pathologies, that result in conflict that would happen whether you were there or not. So some of that was going on. And at the same time, you had the opposition to us. And people began to sort through this. But don't underestimate a couple of things. First of all, in central Baghdad, we went in and we killed a large number of people who finally said, well, we're going to have to do business with these Americans. If we're Sunnis, we have to do business with them because we can't fight the Shiites and the Americans. And then there were a group of people that were Shiite inside Baghdad that were told specifically by the Iranians, stop. Stop fighting and get along. And, of course, those were the Sadrists. But we had to kill a couple of thousand of them. At the same time, in the rest of the country, particularly in Anbar, we employed a lot of cash. In fact, about $750 million in hard cash was printed and flown into Baghdad for General Petraeus to pass out. So we bought the cooperation, but we have to understand that that cooperation came with certain strings, one of which was to essentially let the tribal leaders, the Sunni Arab militia leaders, run their own affairs. In other words, instead of forging this nation state, which we said we were trying to build, we suddenly backed away, recognized that that could no longer be done, and we said, fine, we'll just pay them off and leave them alone. And for the most part, that's worked, although now everyone coming back from Iraq will tell you that's over. The so-called Sons of Iraq and these payoffs, their time has expended or expired, and they are now actively preparing for the next round of fights in Iraq, and they will focus primarily on the Shia. But nevertheless, that's over.
Yeah, I think the fact that we're 5.5 months, I believe it is, that they've been trying to form a government, and that hasn't happened yet, doesn't help us much in that regard. Eagle One.
Well, let me, since we are a Navy-oriented show, let me talk a little bit about your on your Dan Rather interview that Salamander was referring to earlier. You discussed withdrawal of a lot of our forward forces. And kind of bringing the Navy around in the periphery with air power, and I'm looking also at the logistics of getting, if we do need to move heavier units, and I know you're not in favor of the super heavy units we have now, but how much role do you see in the Navy in what you describe as the military of the future?
Well, first of all, let's look at the nature of future warfare. I mean, this is something that's very important. You're raising a very important issue. And let's back up entirely before we start talking about the nature of future warfare. First of all, we need a new national military strategy in the United States. Our current national military strategy is bankrupting us. The Cold War ended. The rest of the world changed. We did not. We have this global network of bases and deployed forces that we simply can't afford and, quite frankly, are really not needed. There's an assumption that has been sort of drummed into people's heads for years that we have to be everywhere and we have to influence everything or bad things will occur. This, of course, was the Madeleine Albright argument about the so-called indispensable nation. So what we really need is a national military strategy that moves away from these self-defeating, nation-building, neo-Wilsonian interventions to make the world safe for democracy, whether we justify it on the grounds of, you know, anti-terrorism or counterinsurgency or globalization or anything else. I think we'll get there because we're simply unable to afford what we're doing. Then the second piece of this is, you know, what have we done historically that works? And one of the things that we've done very well is to look at the air-naval alternative, which is, on the whole, more economical, less intrusive. And today, thanks to the emergence of what I would call the global American ISR strike complex, can be very, very effective. And now, naval power is going to have to be different in its content and structure in the future from what it has been in the past. Hopefully we'll get there. We've had a terrible time with shipbuilding and ship designs and so forth. And those things we're not going to solve today on the phone, but we do have to move down some new avenues there. But if you look at air and naval forces, we can influence most of what we're concerned about beyond our borders without deploying large numbers of ground forces. When it comes to ground forces, and if you do have to go in somewhere and you're going to go in to fundamentally change the situation in your favor, then you're going to need armored forces, because this business of sending men with rifles, we've gotten away literally with murder in many cases in places like Iraq and Afghanistan using them. That's not going to work well against anybody who has any sort of capability. So we're going to have to rethink some of our assumptions about ground forces in the aftermath of this long period of interventionism in Southwest Asia.
I think an interesting parallel to that is we saw the Canadians, since the Korean War, it was all UN peacekeeping, light forces. And we actually saw in the late 90s into 2000 that their whole plan was, we're getting rid of everything that's tracked, we're going light. Well, lo and behold, they put 2,500 plus or minus forces in southern Afghanistan, and they saw very quickly that even in Afghanistan, that this isn't quite working well for us. And they were within a year, from what a Canadian colleague told me, of getting rid of their Leopard 1s. So they contracted with the Ukrainians and to bring in their Leopard 1s, and within a year traded them up for some used German and Dutch Leopard 2s, because they had forgotten a lot of the requirements that you actually need. When you look at the Canadian example and what we've seen in about 3 minutes, asking a three-hour answer in 3 minutes, but what lessons that perhaps we learned going back and validated perhaps in some of your experiences in the first Gulf War, what lessons that we learned and have just atrophied on the vine that, like the Canadians, we need to make sure that we don't forget them going forward?
Well, the lethality of modern warfare is such that if you fight anyone who can fight back, remember, we've been fighting people without armies, without air defenses, without air forces, without any sort of naval capability. If you fight anyone who can fight back, you're going to have tracked armor, because tracked armor provides you with the protection, the armored protection, the mobility, and it can sustain and support heavy firepower. Those things are how you wage ground warfare. And we've been down this road many, many times. Until the Marines took terrible casualties during World War II on Tarawa, the Marine Corps resisted the idea of bringing in Sherman tanks. Then they introduced Sherman tanks, and of course they discovered that against the Japanese, the Sherman tank was a miracle weapon. It didn't do very well against the Germans, but it did very well against the Japanese. We went through this with the Army in Korea in 1950. We said, the terrain is unsuitable to tracked armor, we get rid of it, and of course we're attacked by the North Koreans with 300 T-34 tanks. If you look at the inventory of the world's national military establishments, there are substantial quantities of armor out there. What we're also going to see is a growth in air defenses, because those air defenses are going to come about to neutralize our capacity to strike from the air. No one is going to try and build F-22s or F-15s and fly against us, but they are going to invest very heavily in air defenses, and that's what you're seeing, for instance, with the Chinese. We call it anti-access, they call it prudent defense. The point is that we have to learn the right lessons, and I think right now we build a force really for paramilitary police operations, chasing people with AK-47s and RPGs through the streets. And sadly, you know, we had this obsession with driving up and down the roads when the answer was always to drive off the roads. Ridgway made that point in Korea to everyone, and I think we found it out again in Iraq. The solution was not to stay wedded to the roads so that you would become a target for IEDs, but to get off. And I think those are the things we need to remember, but I don't see much evidence that we're learning much. I mean, a friend of mine who's a captain in the Navy says, Doug, we don't have lessons learned, we have lessons observed.
That's exactly Right, and back when I used to play with the European militaries, they're a little more honest than we are. They call them lessons identified, which leaves the action on the other side up to question. And our half hour is over with, and Colonel McGregor, thank you very much for taking some time this afternoon. You are, I know, up at the the military library speech. People can find online as well, plus your books I have linked to on my website people can get. If people want to hear more of what you have to say or perhaps read some more of the ideas you have, where can they reach out and grab that?
Well, I think the easiest thing to do is just to Google my name, and it'll take you to my website and a number of other sites. And I do hope that people will look at Warrior's Rage. It's an easy read, and it imparts a lot of these lessons that we tragically forgot in 1991, and I think we learned the hard way in places like Fallujah and Najaf and other areas where mobile armored firepower was decisive.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for coming on MIDRAT, and we'll keep an eye on you and hope to hear from you again.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Colonel McGregor.
And just a quick reminder to everybody, you're listening to Navy Milblog Radio MIDRATs. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, and with my co-host Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak, and we're going to reset and pivot here, completely different subject, and we're going on to the second half of the hour. A real quick introduction, we're going to have an all-Navy time here for the second half of the hour. We're bringing on a retired Navy commander, Zoe Dunning. She spent 6 years active duty, 16 years in the reserves. For you math-inclined people, that's 22 years. And we're going to readdress with her a subject that we last covered way back in February on Episode 7, and that is the ongoing discussion about, if not the repeal, the reinterpretation, or the discussion about the wisdom of don't ask, don't tell, and the policy of how homosexuals should and if they should serve on the active duty military. Right now, in among other things she does, Zoe, she is the board co-chair of the Service Members Legal Defense Network. And Zoe, welcome to MIDRATs.
Thanks. I appreciate being here.
Great. And as I always like to thank people, because Sunday can be a difficult time because everybody's schedule gets packed on the weekend. I want to thank your patience for coming on for the second half of the hour and to talk about this subject with us. I think most of our listeners are familiar with the arguments on both sides of the equation, but they may not be familiar with the Service Members Legal Defense Network. If you could you just explain to our listeners what it does and what your role is there?
Sure. Service Members Legal Defense Network, or SLDN, was founded back in 1993 when Clinton announced the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. There was still a lot of confusion, I think, within the military in terms of, you know, how do you enforce the policy? What are people's rights and responsibilities? How does one bring a legal case about? How does one defend against a legal case? And so the two founders of SLDN, Dixon Osborne and Michelle Beneke, who is a former Army captain, they founded this organization called SLDN, and its original mission was basically to provide free legal services to those impacted by the policy. So say that you're a Navy petty officer, or you're a sergeant, or you're a officer in the Marine Corps, and you either discover that you're being investigated and you want to know what your rights are and find out what you can do, or you've been notified that they're going to begin discharge proceedings against you, and you want to turn for legal advice and find out what your rights and responsibilities are, or even get representation in your legal proceedings, you would turn to SLDN. We soon discovered, after about 10 years of that mission, we wanted to do more than just provide legal services. We wanted to actually actively lobby to repeal the law and to allow gays and lesbians to serve in the military without fear of reprisal or discharge. And so we added on to our mission statement lobbying for the repeal of the law. And we have a staff of about 16 full-time based out of Washington, D.C., and I am part of the board of directors for the organization and currently serve as co-chair.
Eagle One.
Well, talk a little bit about your experience how you came to remain on in services as long as you did.
It's a great question. I am sort of this unusual exception to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In brief, back in 93, when President Clinton was about to take office, I proactively came out at a political rally, announced that I was both a naval officer and a lesbian, and the Navy began discharge proceedings against me, as you might imagine. My reasoning for doing that is that I wanted to challenge the constitutionality of what was actually the policy prior to Don't Ask, Don't Tell at that time, because I knew from my own experience, as well as many people that I had come across and met over my time in the service, how damaging these policies that prohibit gay service really are to both military readiness as well as those who serve within it, who live every day worrying that they're going to lose their career that day. So I came out, went through a 2.5-year legal battle. I went through a discharge proceeding under the prior policy, and they voted unanimously to discharge me. But before they could enact it, Clinton announced Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So then they decided to process me through a second administrative discharge board, and this one was under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And not quite sure exactly how or why it happened. Part of it could have been that I had, a stellar record. I'm a Naval Academy graduate, scored very well in all my, fit reps. It served honorably and done very well, so I had that going for me. But also I think just the policy was so new that people weren't exactly sure how one prosecutes it or defends against it, and I put forth my defense strategy, which was, look, when I was at the political rally, I said I'm a lesbian. I didn't say anything more or less than that. I didn't talk about conduct. I didn't talk about a propensity to engage in conduct. I just stated who I am, not anything that I do. And the Board of Officers found unanimously that that was sufficient to rebut the presumption of conduct and voted to retain me, and the Secretary of the Navy approved the findings, and I was allowed to stay in. So I continued serving in the reserves, 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year type of thing. Volunteered for a short while for active duty after 9/11, and served as an open lesbian for 13 years.
I often tell with people in the civilian side of the house when this conversation comes up, and I always get that puppy dog tilt of the head from them when I go, I've always served with gay people, because especially at two of my commands, I had some shipmates. They were homosexuals. Everybody knew they were homosexuals, but honestly, nobody cared. And that's where I came up. My personal opinion had always been, what do we do if Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Well, I always say that in my perfect world, we would go from Don't Ask, Don't Tell to, Don't Care. And that was reinforced by some experience I had later on that I'll have with a follow-on question for you. But I know how I treated my shipmates treated our shipmates who we knew that were gay. And it was very much, just do your job. I don't care. Let's go forward. If you could, please, how was the reception in your then reserve unit for 16 years that you had of your shipmates as you did your job?
It's an excellent question, because I think some of the resistance, any resistance that I did get within my units, it really didn't have to do with the fact that I was lesbian. I think they were just really curious and concerned why I would put my career at risk. And I think there was some concern that I was making the Navy look bad publicly. So I think it had more to do with sort of, loyalty and the brand image of the military and the Navy, and that I was, by bringing up this case, somehow damaging that or making it look bad. It was nothing personal whatsoever.
Atmospherics.
Yeah. And in fact, as I continued to serve, I was able to experience myself what a difference it was to not have to worry that someone's going to find out my secret, and not have to, leave my reserve duty and just go immediately home and not socialize with my shipmates for fear that, the wrong pronoun will slip out, or they'll start asking too many questions. So I actually became much more engaged and had closer connections with my shipmates after I came out, because I no longer had anything to hide.
Eagle One.
Well, in the reserve world, as you say, 1 week in a month and 2 weeks a year and occasional bursts of active duty, That's a far different world than an active duty person in your situation would have experienced. To me, I'm not fully versed in all this, but have you talked to active duty people about, you know, how has that gone for them if they're in a similar kind of circumstance that Salamander talks about, where people know, but, you know, nobody says anything about it. If you get what I'm under.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There are a lot of cases, anecdotally as well as legal cases, of folks who either are out to their shipmates or people highly suspect, and it's not been an issue. In general, I mean, there are always exceptions, obviously, if an individual has difficulty adjusting to that concept or idea that they're serving alongside a gay or lesbian service member, you know, they might act out. But overall, we've got many, SLDN has represented a number of clients who, you know, have come out and had no problems. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach would be one example. He was outed and is fighting his legal case and has continued to serve for the last year and a half without any problem whatsoever, and his shipmates have testified in support of him.
One thing I use for my personal data point, I've had the honor, so to speak, but it was just world view. If I had the pleasure of serving many years with European militaries who somebody takes to dinner on Saturday night hasn't been a concern for a very long time, for instance, the Dutch, but also those that have more recent experience of leaving that behind, the British. And the thing that really hits you is it's really just not an issue. It's not an issue at all amongst people. It reinforces the don't care. And when this discussion, and I'm sure you may have been involved in this, earlier this year when the discussion of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was coming up, I read a little bit where some people in the press, and there's actually a conference that somebody started that had representatives from some of the European militaries to talk about their experience, which is people do their job, we don't worry about it. And it kind of petered off after that, and you didn't see much of it. How much work have you been able to do with some of your European colleagues on the discussion to try to bring in this real world, this isn't theory, this isn't spin, this is how it works, discussion inside the beltway of D.C. to the people who are really going to make this decision?
Oh, it's a great analogy. I mean, many countries, and in fact, I think most, if not all except for ourselves and Turkey, NATO countries allow openly gay service members and have not experienced any problem. The Palm Center, I believe, put on the panel that you were referencing and has done great research on what happens in other countries when they lift their ban. Another experience that's worth noting is that there is a linkage between sexual harassment and policies that prohibit gay service, because a lot of times that is used as leverage against someone. So it's like, you know, if you're going to report me for sexual harassment, I'm going to report you as being an alleged lesbian. And what we discovered in the Canadian military is when they lifted their ban on gay service, there was a 46% reduction in sexual harassment complaints by Canadian women. And so there's definitely a linkage there. And so a lot of those studies, a lot of those experiences have been brought to the attention of Congress and the Pentagon working group that's doing the study currently. So they do have that information to look at. A lot of times the counter argument is, well, we're the U.S. military and we're different. But I would venture to say we're not that different, especially in these types of issues. I think it is somewhat insulting to our own military leadership to say that they can't, you know, deal with the implementation of a repeal and do it in a very professional manner. I don't think that our military is so much different and so much less able to handle it than another military.
Eagle One.
Well, a lot of conversation seems to revolve around the dread on the part of people who are serving that we're going to end up with another group that gets special rights, that has a special day or a special week or a special month. And you know, I think images of unfortunately, sometimes out of control gay rights parades dance through the heads of some of these folks. What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, back to the thing that Commander Salamander said earlier is, you know, you're serving alongside gays right now. It's not like we're introducing some new. In some ways, it's easier than sort of the integration of women or some of the other challenges that the military's had, because gays and lesbians and bisexuals are still serving currently. It's just a matter of whether or not they sort of let you know for sure or confirm that they are. So, you know, the UCMJ is still going to apply if people participate in illegal conduct, then they should be punished appropriately. You know, I don't really see people running around with, you know, boas and, you know, flaming, you know, making out at the officers' club or whatever with their significant other. But, you know, people are probably going to have to get used to the idea that there might be, you know, hand-holding, or there might be, not on duty, but, like, you know, at the officers' club after hours kind of thing. But just getting used to the fact that there are same-sex couples out there in the world.
Actually, I think I've seen some very straight British Royal Marines doing all of that at bars at about 2 o'clock in the morning, but
yeah.
that's a different subject for a different day. I kind of put a tell in the description I put on my home blog of this episode. I called it the fading of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because at least from the cheap seats, the discussions and the arguments seem to have peaked in the springtime, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the effort to repeal it just hasn't been put on the back burner. It's been put in the cupboard or the freezer to be microwaved later. And for me personally, I don't, and this is all anecdotal to me, but it became very difficult for me to defend it among some people, because the initial argument I thought was done exactly right. We're professionals. Let's talk about this as professionals. And just what you said, yes, that problem right there will be addressed by the UCMJ as long as leaders do your job. Are you telling me that you as a leader aren't going to do your job? Of course I'll do my job. Then you got nothing to worry about. But what, and it may have been an accident, it just happened afterwards, but when there were some protests, it turned into what is almost parody-worthy street theater. I'm speaking, of course, to the people who chained themselves to the White House fence wearing uniforms that they really haven't been authorized to wear in a long time. And we're doing things that cease to make this a discussion amongst professionals, but street theater in order to get attention, what I considered, my personal opinion, they were trying to get attention to themselves. And after that, it seems like the conversation has faded. So it's really a two-part question for you. One, inside the community that's lobbying to repeal this, is there some appreciation to keep this on a professional level? And two, from your perspective, why do you think that things are starting to fade into the discussion? Is it because of the election coming up, or people just realize they can't get there from here?
I think you're referring to Dan Choi and some others who had chained themselves to the White House fence, I think, a couple of times now.
Yes, ma'am.
In uniform. And, you know, I respect Dan Choi's desire to pursue civil disobedience as one avenue to bring attention to the issue. My personal opinion, and this is just me speaking, I was also taken aback by the fact he did it in uniform. I think, to your point, it was part of the theater and the media and, you know, trying to make it more, you know, sort of photographic and bold. But I think that did cross the line in terms of wearing your uniform doing it. But, you know, I do support his wanting to bring civil disobedience into it because, you know, he's trying to get a sense of urgency around it. And I think it did create some conversations and cause people to, you know, keep it in the news and keep it abreast of the conversation. With regards to why there hasn't been as much news, you know, there was a lot of congressional action on it back in May. You know, it has not been addressed in the last couple of months, but the Senate is taking the DOD authorization bill up for discussion in mid-September. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal amendment is attached to that. So you'll probably start to see more about it coming up in about middle to late September. You'll probably also see a little bit more coming up about it in around December 1st when the Pentagon study report comes out. There has been a fair amount of media around the surveys that go out there, and, I mean, that's a whole other topic for discussion. I I'm very confused why, and this is the one issue that we decided that we're going to survey the troops on. I think it sets a pretty dangerous precedent in terms of making the military feel like it's a democracy, and the soldiers and sailors have a vote in every policy change that gets made. So I think you'll see some more about the survey. You'll see some more about the congressional action that's going to take place in September, and then some more in December. But it is true that the arguments are switching less and less about whether or not Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be repealed, and more about how do we do it, how do we do it in a smart way.
Eagle One.
Well, that bumps right into my next question, which I think was sort of what I was going to before, which is if Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed, will your organization, or will you take, will you take a position that, that the implementation doesn't have to be much more than just saying, discrimination against gays in the military is over, or are we going to see, as one of the commenters on our chat room said, a gay rights directorate demanding the same sort of thing that we see with some of the other minority groups as we try and continue to fully integrate our service? Do you have a position on that?
SLDN, we're actually going through a strategic planning process right now to figure out exactly what our mission would be if and when Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. And I think there's going to be continued need for us as a nonprofit, again, not part of the military itself, but as a nonprofit, to provide, some legal advice as people figure out, how this works, and also to, in some ways, act as a bit of a watchdog, as we've experienced with, other changes in the military, the integration of women, the integration of African Americans. A policy may change, but deep-seated, bias and discrimination may pop up here and there with individual commands that aren't on board yet, and so there'll probably be a watchdog function for the organization at a minimum. But we're not advocating for any kind of a special directorate within the military. I would assume and hope that issues around sexual orientation would be incorporated into whatever broader diversity training happens within the military. That's how I would envision seeing it once it's repealed.
And that is also one of the big concerns that I have, Zoe, along the same lines that Eagle One has, is unfortunately, I call them the diversity bullies, because they, a lot of it because it's part of an industry that they take ideas and concepts that were very applicable at a certain time, and they shove them in people's face that have no relation. For instance, the young sailors that I've served with are much more open-minded towards people's sexuality than perhaps people who were born 20 or 30 years before they were, simply as a cultural issue. And I think a lot of the problems you have from thick-headed people can be more than handled through the UCMJ, just like we can handle bigots of any stripe via the UCMJ, because usually bigotry is closely tied up with violence. And the minute somebody gets violent, throw the duty jag at him, he'll take care of it. But there's concern, I think, because just as those who advocate gay surgery openly are concerned about the people that are foam-flecked at the mouth, how much they dislike homosexuals to the point that they scream and throw things. But on the other side of the equation, there's always a concern that we get into a binary situation where you have those people on one end, but on the other end, people cease being watchdogs and become advocates, where if you don't adopt the entire agenda, which goes all the way to, and we don't need to talk about it right now, but all the way to gay marriage and gay couples taking base housing, that if you don't agree with the entire agenda, then you are a backwards bigot, and it's going to be reflected on your fitness report. And that's where I think a lot of the people concerned with is they want to let their shipmates serve and just to be left alone in their all private lives, but they're afraid that that's not going to be the end of it, that it's going to keep going to the left. And I go back to my European experience. They don't have the diversity industry like we do. Like, there was an experience in Belgium where they had the biggest controversy, where they had a gay rights parade, and the battalion commander got pink watercolors and had a pink tank in the parade. But that was no big deal. Nobody really cared because they're very easygoing. I think that's the concern, is that things are going to be grinded in their face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see how this thing unfolds. You know, I went through some painful diversity training myself, and you know, as one of the first women to go through the Naval Academy, I certainly felt all eyes upon me when we were forced to go through training that talked about how, you know, we should accept women and blah blah blah. You know, and the military, I don't think has quite gotten diversity training down perfectly yet. And so whenever it's mandatory,
work in progress.
Yeah, whenever it's mandatory, it feels a bit forced, and it's not something that, you know, anyone ever really looks forward to. You know, it's hard to say. I don't think that, you know, anyone's advocating for you, you know, and I always bristle a little bit at this term agenda, like, you know, there's sort of this, you know, list of, you know, demands. But I think people do just want to be able to serve without fear of losing their job. They want to be treated professionally. They don't want any, you know, greater opportunity for promotion, but they just don't want any less of an opportunity for promotion. They want, you know, literally just equal rights. And, you know, I think people don't realize how difficult it is to not talk about your personal life. People are like, well, you know, just leave that at home. You know, your personal is your personal. I don't want to hear about it. I went 2 weeks ago to hear the CNO speak at the World Affairs Council here in San Francisco. And he went up to the podium and he, you know, thanked the person who introduced him, who is in charge of the Marine Memorial Club. And then in his very first sentence, he said, you know, thank you very much. You're very gracious. You know, my wife, I forget her name, my wife and I, you know, so enjoy your hospitality every time we come. And, you know, she and I thank you so much. No, he literally came out as being heterosexual in the first sentence of his speech. And I think people just don't realize, like, how natural that is and how, you know, and that's something that, you know, like a gay person can't do currently under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it seems really minor, but it's just sort of, it's interesting when people are like, well, you know, don't bring that into the workplace. And it's like, well, everyone else brings it into the workplace. You just don't realize you do.
And Zoe, I think you hit on something that's exactly right. You know, we can talk about professional, but there is a very human side to it. One of the things that formed my view of life is one of the most loving and caring relationships that I saw growing up is one of my mother's employees. He was in a very committed relationship for a very long time, and he contracted HIV and pretty much the second wave of it in the 1980s, and his partner was with him every step of the way through his illness and eventually his death. And it was that relationship that you can have regardless of you know, what somebody's XX or XY combination is. It's something that is an important part of a person's life. And I agree, that would be one of the best things that we could have from this, is people no longer have to worry about what pronoun they're using when they discuss this situation. Eagle One, next.
Well, I mean, a lot of us who had friends who were involved with the HIV death situation had our eyes open to the number of gays both in our society and the effect that that problem caused, still causes. But I do have a concern that that you talked about. You mentioned, you know, no greater opportunity for promotion, but no lesser either, which means I see a check mark somewhere on a fit rep or somewhere. Somebody's going to have to keep track of this stuff. You know, are we promoting gays equally with heterosexuals or whatever, and I'm concerned about that. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Well, I mean, I don't, because it's such a personal thing, it's a little less check the box, like, you know, maybe race or gender is. I don't foresee anyone in the Pentagon tracking, you know, promotions of gay, lesbian, and bisexual folks and how it compares and contrasts to the greater population. Because, quite frankly, I don't think that many people are actually going to self-identify as gay who are. I think we're going to be underwhelmed at the response when Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. I think, again, it's just the fact that I can live without fear. I may not actually come out to my shipmates, my cohorts. And so I think it's impossible to track who's gay and lesbian, because I think a lot of people still won't self-identify. They just are going to, you know, do it without, you know, just serve without having to worry that they are going to get fired for it. So, I don't see anyone tracking that. I don't see anyone, but I do want to, you know, say that if people are getting discriminated against, maybe not promotion is the best example, but if they're getting harassed or there's a problem, spray painting faggot on their, you know, bunk bed or something like that, which does happen, that's a conduct issue that gets treated, you know, by the UCMJ and gets followed up appropriately.
And
just
I think
just as anything else, you know, that they would do inappropriately like that.
Yeah, but I think the UCMJ definitely covers that and should cover it well. And Zoe, thank you very much for your time this soon-to-be evening. I think we could have gone another half hour. And the live show nobody's going to hear, but being that most people catch it on the archive, they'll be able to. So if people wanted to find out more about what you do and your organization, where would be a good place for them to go?
Our website is Sierra Lima November Delta, SLDN. Did I get that right? Delta November, excuse me.
Exactly.
Dyslexic there. .org, SLDN.org, and there's a lot of information there about the organization, about the policy, the history of the policy, the current legislative situation. I'm on Twitter, so Zoe Dunning on Twitter, if anyone wants to follow, and I usually give a lot of updates on what's going on the issue. And so you can find out more there.
Outstanding, and thanks again, and I hope you have a good fall on the way for you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Zoe.